100 years of war. This is the story of the unwavering wives who fought the U.S. government to ensure no man is left behind. Right here, right now, on
VT Radio. Let's go. With host Johnny Punish.
We're back on VT Radio. Now, every few months, an emotional news story is released about a family who receives unexpected word that the remains of their grandfather, their father, brother, uncle, husband, or son have been located 50 or even 75 years after disappearing during the battles in Germany, Italy, Belgium, North Korea, or even Vietnam. Our nation makes a sacred promise to families who send their loved ones to war to leave no man behind. But only since the Vietnam War has the United States actually upheld this promise. Now, my guests today are Taylor Baldwin Kylan and Judy Silverstein Gray. They're both military veterans and authors of multiple books, but they have just released a new history of America's No Man Left Behind policy. And it's called Unwavering, The Wives Who Fought to Ensure No Man Is Left Behind. And Taylor and Judy, welcome to the show. I want to say thank you for coming on. This is a really important subject for so many military families in the United States, and it's intense. And so I want to talk to you. Taylor, we'll start with you. Tell us a little bit more about the book and how you came to be writing this book.
Well, thank you so much, Johnny, for having us on your show. I was 6 years old living in the small island of Coronado, California, when our POWs from Vietnam were released and came home. And I have memories of the homecoming banners, the yellow ribbons, and I grew up with several of the POW and MIA families. That left an indelible mark on me. Fast forward to year 2000, I volunteered for the McCain for President campaign and met many of the POWs who were campaigning on his behalf, and I was struck by what a unique group of men they were, that they still are the longest-held group of POWs in our nation's history, and they were extremely successful in captivity and post-captivity. And so I wrote a couple of books about them and developed friendships and relationships with a lot of them, and about 8 years ago, one of them called me and said, Taylor, there's been a lot written about us and our epic battle in captivity in the Hanoi Hilton, but there's been much less written about the epic home front battle that our wives waged against the U.S. government. And there should be a book about it. And I said, you know, Captain Stratton, you were right. And so I embarked on this journey 8 years ago and recruited my friend Judy to help me.
Incredible. And Judy, how did you get associated with Taylor? Did she call you on the phone? Or tell us more about that.
Taylor and I, thank you again, by the way, for having us on. Taylor and I knew each other because we had worked on some other books about both the Coast Guard and the Navy. And when she told me about this story and said, what do you think? It immediately captivated me because it didn't take me long to realize in the 1960s, women had a very different life. So how did they do this? And she began to educate me about what No Man Left Behind really means and what it meant for women to speak out. For example, women had very little, shall we say, agency in their mid-1960s. They pretty much lived life very similar to how women lived life in the 1950s. And for military wives, it was even more structured, and there was a lot of protocol they had to abide by. For example, some women still wore gloves to lunch. The only jobs they could hold were basically relegated to nursing, teaching, being a happy homemaker, perhaps social work, but mostly nursing, school teaching, and being a secretary. And so it was under these rules that the women decided they would follow the rules and abide by the very strict guidelines, but then they would maybe start to speak out and they started observing. And we'll take you through that a little bit later.
Okay. Now, I understand the story of Sybil Stockdale, is that right? And Candy Parrish, Pat Means, and Carol McCain. Is that part of your book?
Yes.
Taylor, can you tell me about that?
Yes. So those names that you mentioned are a handful of the hundreds of wives who defied the government's edict to keep quiet when their husbands were captive or missing in during the Vietnam War. The government initially told them, you cannot tell anyone outside your family that your husband is missing or captive, because we are afraid that this information might be used against the men in captivity, or that it might jeopardize our negotiations in Paris with the North Vietnamese. So these women initially did keep quiet. They really were well indoctrinated into the military protocol and the rules, and were very fearful that their men might be hurt if they spoke out, especially to the press. But after 3 years, at least 3 years of silence and no progress by the government to obtain a full list of the men who were being held captive, an abiding of the Geneva Conventions for humane treatment, neutral observations, regular mail, these women had had enough, and they boldly and bravely went public. And the first one to go public was Sybil Stockdale. She gave an interview with the San Diego Union in the fall of 1968.
Wow. Okay, so she was the first brave one to step forward.
Correct, and go public.
In a world where women didn't step forward, am I getting that correct?
Correct.
Absolutely.
I think most Americans, they don't identify with that anymore. I think when you talk about the 50s and 60s, how women had different roles in society, that's really changed. I mean, compared to those days, right? I mean, I guess the picture of the housewife with an apron on, is that right? Leave it to Beaver, am I getting that right?
Yes,
absolutely.
You are.
Yeah, that was the role model for military wives, for sure. And it was considered disrespectful to disparage the military, to violate the hidebound rules that they lived under. So it was a pretty bold move to actually go public and give an interview with the media, and to denounce publicly the treatment that the men were receiving in captivity.
Judy, what was going on really behind the scenes with the government? Why were they being so uncooperative and so unhelpful to the families? I don't quite understand that. Can you give me a little more insight into that, please?
Certainly. So, Johnny, I think we have to think in context here. If you think back that Cold War era tactics, back channel diplomacy, if you will, was working very successfully. You can only have to think back to Gary Powers, shot down in 1960 in his U-2 spy plane. And the government was very successful at negotiating quietly his release in 1962, and it was considered a triumph. So they probably labored under those policies because it was successful. And frankly, families weren't part of the equation of releasing military men. So when we got to Vietnam, the other point that I think in context makes sense is that Vietnam was very small. It wasn't very well known to Americans. It was a small Asian country, and we were a large, powerful U.S. military. The conventional wisdom was, how long could it take to win a war with a country this size?
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Almost like the size of Grenada or something, a little Caribbean island or something, it feels like, right?
Correct. And with no internet, it wasn't as if.
But it wasn't.
Right. It wasn't. I don't think we even knew as a country how long and bitter that war with the French had been. So in that context of not really knowing, this all made sense. So when someone says, keep quiet, and besides, the North Vietnamese are signatories to the Geneva Convention, which allowed our men to, or any captured men, to receive humane treatment, medical care. As Taylor said, it allowed for inspections of prison camps. And it also allowed for mail between the families. We assumed this was going on. And over 3 years, the families began to realize that keeping quiet and on the sidelines was not as effective as being on the front lines, even for them.
Wow. So it must have been an intense time in those years.
I think so.
Taylor, let me ask you a question. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Judy.
No, and I don't think we understand nearly enough about how stoic and brave these women were waging their own battle.
Right. Gotcha. Now, Taylor, you had personal connections with these ladies that are in your book. I think you mentioned Carol McCain. I thought there was Cindy McCain. I wasn't aware of Carol McCain. Is that his first wife, or did I get that wrong or right?
Yes, what is your connection there? That was his first wife. I grew up with Carol and John McCain's first family, specifically their daughter, Sydney. She and I went to high school together. I don't know his second wife or and their children at all. Yes, John McCain met and married Carol McCain in 1965. This was the second marriage for her. She actually first married one of John McCain's Naval Academy classmates. She had met both John and this other man in college, but was got engaged and got married to a friend of John McCain, had two children with him, and then she got divorced in 1964. And when she was traveling to visit a friend in Pensacola, Florida, in 1964, she was going to the funeral of a friend of hers husband's. She reconnected with John McCain and they started dating and they got married in 1965 and had my friend, Sidney McCain, about a year later. He deployed to Vietnam in 67, fall of 67, and was shot down in October of 67. And most people know the rest of the story.
Yeah, I mean, the John McCain story in Vietnam is quite famous, a prisoner of war. And did that spark Carol to take action? Is that what that was with Sybil? Is that how that happened?
Yes. Yeah, so when she was informed by the senior officer and a chaplain that her husband was captured, the chaplain very sympathetically, wink, wink, said to her, Mrs. McCain, I'm here for you. I'm in my office Monday through Friday, 8 to 4. Mm-hmm. And she thought to herself, well, what if I need you a Saturday at 10? But he was only available Monday through Friday, 8 to 4. There was just not a whole lot of support for the families. There was no structured policy as to how to support them over the months and then eventually the years. But she received an interesting letter in the mail in early 68. It was from a French journalist who had just returned from filming John McCain in captivity in Hanoi. And if you Google this this film, you can find it online. It's a hospital bed interview that he's given. He's very, very injured, and he's only recently captured. And this journalist writes her a letter and says, I have just interviewed your husband, and I want you to know that he wants me to send you birthday wishes, and he loves you, and he can't wait to be reunited with you. So she calls this French journalist, and she said, I have to meet you, and I have to get a copy of that tape. So she flies to Paris by herself, meets him at a French Parisian cafe, and he agrees to give her a copy of this tape as long as she doesn't sell it. And then she has a harebrained idea, and she says, Monsieur Chalet, she said, I would like to embed myself in your film crew and pose as a grip or as a photographer and go with you the next time you go to Hanoi to interview any POWs. And he chuckles and he says, well, Mrs. McCain, that's a great idea, but I don't think the Vietnamese are going to let me back in. But I thought it was a very, very bold idea of hers that she was actually willing to do that.
Very, very assertive. Now, let me ask you, Judy, this No Man Left Behind, how did it come to be in its current legacy on recent conflicts such as Afghanistan, the war over there, and this kind of thing? Kind of explain it to our listeners and readers, please, because we need more of an understanding of that.
So Americans have always believed that we left no man behind, but as we contend, we really just left our missing. And in fact, they were sometimes declared dead after hostilities ended. But the women wanted to know. They wanted a list. They felt that it was a humanitarian issue, and they wanted to know, were they wives or were they widows? and it was inhumane to them and inconceivable. So they pressed for this. They met with congressmen. They met locally with representatives. They met with people in their community, anyone who would listen. They educated college students, and they did this all against the backdrop of what was going on in the 1960s, which, as you might remember, are tumultuous. And at the time, they were emboldened, probably, by watching people speak out and speak up about issues that were important to them. So they pressed for this. They testified before Congress. As Taylor mentioned, they went overseas. They met with world leaders, trying to get this list of an accounting, basically, for the men. Who were prisoners? Where were they? And who were missing and unaccounted for? And what were we doing about that? And they literally changed policy so that Americans can no longer tolerate a POW or an MIA. We understand that during war, there are casualties. And that seems to be something we accept. But we will not accept POWs or MIAs any longer. And so it's no accident that America ended its longest war in Afghanistan without a single man left behind. Now, the other thing that's important is to note that this accounting is just basically all they asked for. They didn't initially ask for the men to be released, but they spoke loudly and determinedly and were persistent about this issue so that they basically became the centerpiece of the Paris peace negotiations and made their mark. And it was indelible, and we all benefit from it today.
Incredible. Now, Taylor, why the POW MIA flag? It flies over the White House, the U.S. Capitol, and every U.S. post office. Explain that to us, why that's true, Taylor.
Well, the families made it so. The families insisted that it become federal law that this flag fly over every federal building and every post office in the country. You can't drive 5 miles in the United States without seeing this flag. But this symbol was created by the families during the Vietnam War. They wanted some sort of a visible symbol. Sadly, they never trademarked it. So the National League of Families, the organization that the women created during the war, never benefited financially from this symbol. But that symbol became iconic and took off. And as you well know, it has outlived the war and it has become a symbol of patriotism. It has become a symbol of our commitment to leave no man behind.
Right. Now that symbol was created by the National League of Families?
By these women, yes.
Well, you learn something new every day. And I've been in the veterans business for 18 years. I did not know that.
Yes.
Gosh, I apologize to our listeners for not knowing that.
Johnny, you might be interested to know that the other icon that was tremendously successful for the women were the POW bracelets, which were made out of copper and aluminum. And Taylor's got one on right there.
Okay.
And
cool.
It was engraved with the name and rank of someone missing or a POW, the date of loss. And it rallied the nation at a time when things were very tumultuous and divisive around the humanitarian side of a war that seemingly nobody could agree on. And it became personal. I remember being 12 years old and having a camp counselor saying, "Do you have $2.50? Because everybody should wear it, and you should wear it until these men come home." And you didn't really understand the war necessarily at 12, but you did understand that these were our Americans that were left behind or missing. And so what the women did was brilliant. They had a flag as an icon, and they had bracelets that were created by a group of students, and they partnered with them. And they were so wildly successful that they sold more than 5 million of those bracelets.
Holy moly, that's a lot. In 1968 America, that's a lot.
Yes. I mean, celebrities wore them. Princess Grace wore one. Frank Sinatra wore one. Sonny and Cher wore one. Ronald Reagan wore one. It became an issue that both Americans who were against the war and for the war could rally around, the fate of the missing and captive men.
Because for everybody, even if you're for the war, it was still an important thing, right? I mean, obviously, for every American, is that correct?
Well, I would make a strong argument that once winning the war no longer became the objective, getting the men home, getting the POWs home, became our primary objective for this war.
Yeah, incredible. And in fact, now, that was during a time, the Vietnam War in the 60s, you're dealing with the Nixon administration, Bob McNamara, you're dealing with the hippie movement, you're dealing with flower power. There was a lot of conflict. I don't want to gloss over that and pretend that that wasn't really intense. I mean, go ahead. Can you speak to that, Judy?
It was intense. It was, when we wrote the book initially, we were listening to 1960s and 70s music to inspire us. In fact, we have a Spotify playlist we created.
But Tambourine Man or what?
Yes, things like that. Even the times they were changing. Yeah, these boots are made for walking. But even the times they are changing in 1964 or 65, women were already finding themselves the head of household. That was unheard of in the military. We laid out the protocol that they followed where they were to support their men and, you know, be a guest at their own dinner party and entertain without a maid as outlined in the Navy Wife. But in fact, they were going back to work. They were trying desperately to cash their husband's military paychecks. Meanwhile, we had campus unrest. We had race wars going on. We had a recognition that Watergate. Women could be elected to... Yeah, Watergate was going on. We had a recognition that, that we wanted parity of pay for women. And meanwhile, they were, I would say, resolute that they were going to get... They were going to be heard, and these men were going to be accounted for. And that's why Leave No Man Behind becomes really important. And Johnny, something else that we kind of touched on, the families really wanted some care for families of the future of military members. And so now when a family member deploys, there's preparation, there's explanation of how long your power of attorney will last. There is a Q&A. There's an ombudsman at a unit that helps liaise between the government and the family. There's internet. There are many more opportunities to communicate. And there isn't a war playing out every night on TV with no other way to find out what's going on. And so it was a really different time. And I believe as we researched the book, it seemed as if the women were saying, almost everyone around us is speaking up. We have to stay true to this.
Right. Now, Taylor, do you ladies have personal experience in this? Or are you just the writers of this book? Or is there something connection to your families at all?
No, we don't have POWs or MRAs in our family. We both are veterans. And we both come from a family of veterans. We're both third generation veterans. But no one in our family has been a POW or an MIA.
So it's just a matter of empathy that you felt this need to help and send that message for the ladies. Is that correct?
We see this as one of the little known legacies of the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
Right. We need to make a movie about your book because I think we need to get that out. Not only the book out there, but get it on Netflix or something. You know what I mean? And educate the public, don't you think?
We do.
That would be great. We would love that.
It's highly
My daughter
visual.
Happens to work for PBS. She's a documentary maker. She's actually greenlights all the PBS documentaries. It's a company called ITVS. They're actually – PBS is the distribution channel, but ITVS is the production company funded. So I'll mention it to her, and I'll try to – get her, nudge her a little bit, see what I can do for you.
Let us know. We'll put her in touch with our agent. Absolutely.
I will. She's very difficult. I mean, she's hard on dear old dad, you know, because, you know, all I want to hear about is about Tom Cruise and Maverick. And she tells me, that's not how it is, Dad.
You know, but along those lines, Johnny, we wrote this very cinematically. Lots of descriptions. It took months to draw out details from women who had not tapped into these 50 to 57-year-old memories. What color was your couch? What kind of a phone was it? Did the rotary phone hang on the wall? Did you wear an apron that was long or short? You know, again, trying to paint a picture of how quickly life changed for these men and then eventually for the POWs. You know, when we started our story, where it starts, hemlines are long, haircuts for men are short, and then it reverses.
Mm-hmm. Right. Complete reverse, right? short skirts, mini skirts, boots, and all that stuff, right?
You got
a lot of POWs mentioned
hair and all that kind of stuff.
That's true. The other thing I wanted to tell you is last night at a book talk we gave, a woman walked up to me that I've known for 25 years, and she started to cry, and she said, my stepfather was a POW in World War II, and this was the most cathartic information I have ever heard about a book that made me recognize what my dad did was incredibly brave. So these stories resonate, and these are trailblazers who laid the groundwork for women to speak up and speak out and do the work they need to do, just like men.
Beautiful. Now, Taylor, tell us the state of the No Man Left Behind in 2023. Where are we at right now? Are we in a good place? Could we be in a better place?
Well, we currently still have about 1,500 men missing from the Vietnam War. That is a tiny fraction of the number of missing from World War II in Korea. We have 72,000 missing from World War II. And more than 7,000 missing from the Korean War. So you can see it's pretty obvious that we didn't put the effort into finding our missing until Vietnam. Of course, we lost many, many more men during those previous wars. But today we have a government agency called DPAA, the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency, that has an annual budget of $130 million and a staff of 700 professionals that combs the globe all year round looking for remains from all wars. That organization was created in 1973. It had a different name. And guess who insisted that it be created? The families.
Right.
The families insisted that a permanent organization be created after the war was over so that the search for the missing would continue.
Beautiful. So would you say we're in good shape right now?
Good shape. Well, we still have missing men. The mission is to for the fullest possible accounting. Everyone realizes that we're never going to recover every single missing man. There are thousands that are at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean that will never be recovered.
Yeah, but World War II was so long ago, too. I mean, you're talking about, is that 80 years ago, right? Yeah.
Yes, but you'd be surprised. They were recovering remains of World War II veterans, World War II KIA, all the time. They exhumed a bunch of bodies from Punch Bowl Cemetery in Hawaii and took some commingled remains. And with DNA technology, which, of course, that has helped, we didn't have that technology 50, 60, 70 years ago. They have been able to identify remains that were unidentified 75 years ago. And there are many families, in some cases, they're second or third generations later, that are receiving closure today.
Yeah. On that note, I'm going to not let you go yet, but I have to tell a little story. I was in Europe last year in France, and I was in a city called Strasbourg, which is on the border of France and Germany. And there's a church there. If you haven't been there, go there. Their biggest church. And there's a plaque inside the church. And I just glanced. I didn't even know it was there. And I was walking by, and it said something, thank you. And I'm like, well, what's this? And it was in English. And I read it. And I'm like, it said, thank you for the U.S. military for liberating Strasbourg during World War II to all the men, women, and families that suffered to liberate our city. We thank you. In a sense, you could see it online. You can look up the plaque. And it just floored me, because it takes you back to how important that was to the world, right? And we forget that. We forget how important the good work that we do means so much to so many people. And it'll make you cry. So, I mean, I was in tears, but, you know, don't want you to cry right now. But, you know, it was really emotional to realize that and to know that you – now they're looking back and trying to recover a lot of those men that perished in, you know, saving Strasbourg and all over Europe is incredible. So I want to thank you ladies for doing this amazing work and putting out this book. That's why I had you on today. I wanted to share that knowledge with our listeners and readers at VT Foreign Policy. Can you tell us about your book and how the best to buy it and find it for the readers and listeners out there? Taylor?
Absolutely. We have a website. It's unwaveringbook.com. So that's waveringbook.com. But you can also get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookshop.org, and in select booksellers around the country.
And Judy, and when did the book actually come out?
It was released last week, May 2nd, and it's very appropriate for this weekend, Mother's Day. It's also appropriate for all the upcoming holidays we have, but it's a good cinematic read. We take you back in time and we do it non-chronologically, and it's very visual. So there's something for everyone. Our male readers have been telling us they're really enjoying the history and learning about the 60s, and it's an important time and chapter in our life as Americans.
Absolutely. Okay. On that note, I want to say thank you for being on VT Radio. We really appreciate it, ladies. We're going to make sure we put this blog post on our site, link to all the sites like Amazon and to your website as well. And just an amazing story. If you're listening out there, please support the ladies, buy the book, and get that read. And I'll be talking to my daughter, Jeanette. If you're out there listening to me, come help these ladies. Let's get this documentary out for them. Very important stuff. You're welcome. And also, VT readers, if you like the show, don't forget to like, subscribe, whoever you're listening to on Spotify, if you're on YouTube or whatever, support VT Foreign Policy, become a member, donate a one-time thing if you like. We're all over. Just go to our website at vtforeignpolicy.com. And that's about it for today. Ladies, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Have a terrific week.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this presentation, hit the like button now. Also, share it with your friends. And don't forget to subscribe so that you don't miss an episode.
VT approves this message.